Military Mountains Mortgage. I have today David Klock, financial advisor, father, husband, Caro Trail through hiker. Love that one. And just overall, very interesting guy. Mutual friend connected us. Mm-hmm. And when he calls and says he's got somebody I need to talk to, I listen, because everybody that keeps company with him, shout out Destin, is interesting, because he's a uniquely interesting person. And so I'm like, who do you have in your Rolodex that I need to know? And when he mentioned you, I was like, yeah, let's chat. And then we hit it off immediately. So I'm super excited here today. Obviously, the goal of the podcast is always just to have really interesting conversations with people. But with your background in finance, maybe we can color that in a little bit. You know, just with you know, those actionable first things that any person can take, that first step to building wealth and financial security and those kinds of things. So I'm sure that'll come up. But without further ado, who's David Klock?
Thank you. My name is David. I'm a friend of Dustin's, apparently, and amongst the thousands of friends that he has, it's quite a feather in my cap to be introduced to folks. I am a Colorado kid since as long as I can remember, who grew up in Fort Collins.
Nice.
In my adult life, I moved around much more than I thought I would, much more than I probably wanted to after a while.
Yeah.
I'm a financial advisor, like you said. I'm a former teacher. I'm a skier. I'm a musician. I'm a father and a husband, more importantly than those things.
Yeah. Those are the best titles.
They are, right? I mean, at the end of the day, I don't care what kind of run I just did at Arapahoe Basin. I want my daughter to give me a hug.
Yeah. Isn't it? Well, one day she'll be able to take them. She'll take laps with you.
If I do it right. Yeah.
Sure. Baby girl. As a father, I'm a girl dad as well. I got two girls. And do you got brothers?
I have two sisters.
Okay. Yeah, so you know the game.
In the middle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I grew up with brothers. I got three brothers and a sister. Okay. And growing up, I was like, oh, I'm gonna have boys.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, and then my dad's side of the family, all of his brothers had boys. And so like, oh, I'm just gonna have boys. And then I've had girls, and it's been so much fun to see that from that perspective.
I'm curious what I assume then, correct me if I'm wrong, but I assume you think, oh, I'm gonna have boys because that's what you know and that's what you grew up with, right? Yeah. What then, like, what changes in your schema when you find out you're having a little girl?
Ooh, well, the first one, it was what it was, you know? And then the second one, we weren't going to find out, and then the doctor messed up.
Oh, no.
And gave us the chromosomal information.
Seriously.
And so we're like, oh, I guess we're having another girl. And we found out the gender by accident. And so then I was like, well, I already know, you know, what to do there. But when my older daughter just is like, Dad, I love you, and she gives me a hug, like, there's nothing better. And obviously, that's not a gender thing. If your son did that too, that'd be great. But just, I don't know, there's something about it. A father and a daughter, you know, I don't really know how to articulate it or explain it, but there's just a really cool bond. And my daughter's like my little buddy. So it's fun.
I love it.
So first kid, how's your introduction into fatherhood been?
I have used the phrase that it's the most exhausting dream come true ever.
That's good.
I'm only 15 months into it, so I'm as green as they come. But it genuinely is the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. I was never that guy who only thought, oh, I want to have a family. Like, there was other things on my mind, and I had it in the back of my mind, yeah, I'd like to have a family someday. And I was ready years ago, and it didn't happen for a myriad of reasons. But when it did, man, my wife and I were, I was up in Colorado at the time when we found out we were pregnant. She's from Colombia, South America, and was there when we found out. And she called me over FaceTime, and I literally had left Colombia maybe 24 hours before that.
Right? Oh, okay.
So I'm like unpacking my things in our house, and I'm whatever, I don't know, probably having a beer. And she goes, well, I got something to tell you. And then she just showed me on the couch in our place in Colombia, she showed me this teddy bear, a pair of shoes, and a pregnancy test.
Nice.
And it felt like game on.
Nice.
Like we weren't trying, but what great timing. It was good. It was just cool. Because the fact that it happened made it great, you know? What was your question?
I just like it. The spontaneity of it too. It's just, you don't know really what you're capable of until it happens. And I think, you know, every professional development you've ever been a part of or grad school, schooling, you read all the books and there's all those things. But you can be prepared for the business world. You can prepare for life. But once you become a parent, it's a whole new ball game. And they always say, like, what is your why? You know, like Simon Sinek, you know, sure. Start with why. You know, that's a pretty quintessential book. But, like, what is your why? And then once you have kids and you see that little girl at the end of a really rough day, you've been in the email inbox all day, you've been on the phone or whatever it may be, you see that little girl and it's like, focus.
Yep. Nothing else matters.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. Yeah. And well said. That's, I mean... Yeah, I don't have anything to add to that.
Nice. Well said. Cool. So Fort Collins, that town has grown.
No kidding.
My God. Dad went to CSU, 1970s.
Yeah.
Graduated there with a construction management degree in the 70s. And so we'd go up there quite a bit to go visit and like alumni things or whatnot and CSU games over all the years. And then I lived in Fort Collins in end of 2007.
Okay.
And even now in 2025, it's nuts how much development's gone on up there.
It's different.
So.
Yeah. Well, yes and no. It's different, I think, because it's, twice the size as back then?
Oh, wow. Okay.
I'm pulling that number out of thin air. I don't know. But it feels like it.
It tracks.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what Mr. Google told me. And it kind of, to me, it just feels like a continuation of the trajectory it was on to begin with, if that makes any sense, you know? I feel like Fort Collins has always been this little, forward-looking, maybe not the fastest moving, but forward-looking spot in northern Colorado, and they're still doing that.
Yeah.
And they're doing it well. Yeah, it's a cool spot. I love it. I haven't lived there, significantly more than a couple months since, 2003?
Okay. Your family still up there?
Yeah, most of them. My folks, my sister and brother-in-law and their family, they all actually just moved from Fort Collins to Windsor at different points in the last 5 years.
Nice.
But yes.
Northern Colorado is going through revival's not the right word, but maybe like a resurgence, or it's just the amount of development. I mean, obviously there's land to develop,
right. But
again, Family Guy, and I just know maybe, you know, if you have a yellow Ferrari, all you see is yellow cars, you know. Sure. But when I see intentional family living lifestyle and all that, it seems like Northern Colorado is really driving that home right now.
Yeah, for sure.
From Longmont to Loveland and all of that up there is getting after it.
They're playing into their strengths, I think.
Yeah.
Yep.
Those planned developments, those planned communities.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, you'd know more about that than anybody, right?
Yeah. But I'm seeing it on bookend on either side of the city, even down south. Douglas County, Castle Rock, Castle Pines is just blowing up.
Really?
Castle Rock is on that list. And same as Fort Collins over the years. They've been on, the USA Today's top 100, small towns in America list. They're always one of them is always on it.
Somewhere in the front range, right? Superior I forgot who else has been up there, but
yeah,
they're well represented.
Did you go to CSU out of high school?
I did not. I graduated from UNC ultimately.
Okay.
Really. So most of my education was around Colorado. There was a couple stints here and there elsewhere. Northern Colorado, Greeley.
Nice.
Finished there. It took me 5 years, and that there's nothing wrong with that. a lot of people go to college for 7 years. Yeah, and then kind of went all over. I was in the D.C. area immediately after UNC, living in Washington, D.C., teaching in Maryland.
Okay.
After that, I came back to Denver for 4 or 5 or 6 years, something like that. Went to Malaysia after that, and then Seattle after that, Columbia, and now back to Denver.
Cool. So teaching background, what were you teaching?
Mostly music. So of my 14 years were in middle school and high school orchestra. There was 5 or 6 years there also teaching Spanish.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So walk me through a relatively young guy moving to Malaysia to teach music.
Yeah, yeah. That was a trip. My ex-wife was born and raised in Southeast Asia.
Okay.
Had always wanted to go back there. So we spent a couple years looking for gigs that would get us out there.
Right? Nice.
She was a social worker. I was a teacher. So I was looking in international schools, and I found this one that was a plant. It was their first year, but they were like this plant from a really, really well-established school in Singapore. Mm. So they needed to hire an entire faculty. Like, they built the facilities and everything, and planned on opening up for like 285 students, right? So they hired the entire faculty, hired me on for music and Spanish, and I signed the contract and said, cool, I've never been to that part of the world. I'd been to that part of the world, but never Malaysia. Sold a bunch of our things here in Denver, did the garage sale, made $17 on, you know, the 94 things that we sold.
Yeah.
Got on a plane and left. And the idea was, I had this 3-year contract.
Okay.
Because most international schools have either a 2 or 3 year contract just so they don't have to hire.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Because those, I mean, they put so much money into hiring somebody from wherever they might be from in the world. So we're like, all right, well, we're going to be there for 3 years, maybe longer. And the idea was we might live in Southeast Asia the rest of our lives. And then we were back in the States a year later. So it was a good year in a lot of senses. I learned a lot. I met a lot of great people.
Oh, I'm sure.
And like lost a lot of weight from stress and overwork.
Did you get some time to get around the country though and kind of experience Malaysia?
Less than you would think, but okay. The short answer is yes.
Okay.
Like I said, I was being overworked a lot. So I'd get, you know, like a day off a month.
Wow. That's not much at all.
Right. Right. So, you know, when those days would come up, we would get out of Dodge and go see what we could see. And then most of travel came in. We had, what was it, like 2 weeks off at the end of December, like every school has. The expectation was that we would work for at least one of those weeks. And by that point, I was like, no, I'm not going to work for one of my 2 weeks off. So we traveled a bunch in December, saw my ex-wife's family. They used to always take like Christmas vacation in Thailand. So we would do that. And then I had a week off in March, April, May, whatever spring break was. And traveled a little bit then too.
Nice.
Yeah.
I desperately want to get to Southeast Asia. I've heard nothing but good things. Yeah. Everybody always has just incredible stories. And my mom is from Vietnam.
No kidding.
So I'd like to get to Vietnam. And so she's talking about going there next year with her brother. Neither of them have been back since they left.
Wow.
During the Vietnam War.
Okay.
And so I think that'd be pretty cool. Go with the mom and go back to her roots and see, you know, I'm sure we have family that we don't know, sure. Right? So we've got no contacts, but it would be cool to kind of go experience that. So
where in Vietnam is she from?
She was born in Saigon. So outside of Saigon, you know, I wouldn't be able to reference it, but sure. A small town outside of Saigon. And, so yeah, we're talking about maybe next year trying to get out there.
Good on you.
Yeah.
Good on you.
Did you ever get into Vietnam?
Yeah. Yeah. I went once. That's where my ex grew up most of her life.
Okay. Cool.
In Hanoi. So yeah, I've only been to Hanoi, but yeah, it's a different world, man. It's a different world.
I could eat a banh mi every day.
No kidding. Preach. Absolutely.
I just had one last week at a brewery that I'm like, okay, this is pretty good. This is pretty good banh mi. It's not too shabby for a brewery.
Good. If you got both of those things going on, you got a good business.
Yeah.
There's a good spot over on Federal, just south of Alameda a little ways. That's my banh mi place.
Oh, Federal. Growing up, my mom would take us to all the Vietnamese restaurants around town, and it seems like the best ones are always on Federal.
Without question.
We should go catch a banh mi one of these days down there.
I'm up for it, always.
Nice. So came back from Malaysia, came back to the States. And what interests me about your story is that you've had some pivots, you know, some road bumps along the way.
No kidding.
You know, you were doing this. Like you said, you thought you were going to do 3 years in Malaysia. Here you are 1 year later. So what is it about you? Like, you know, have you always been resilient? Have you always been able to pivot? Or is that a learned skill that you've kind of been able to develop over the years?
Thank you. Thank you for that. I hadn't looked at it from that lens, honestly. Man, before you saying that, I probably would have just said it's need, right?
Yeah, right. Necessity. Like
we do what we have to do. But no, I think I've always, if I'm being fair with myself, gotten a little restless after a handful of years.
Okay.
Either restless or curious. Maybe that's the more positive adjective.
Yeah.
But I'm a genuinely curious person, and like if something isn't working, it's kind of like, all right, well, what's next then? What do we change about it? If the whole thing doesn't need to be thrown out, what do we keep and what do we not keep? And yeah, some of that is out of necessity. Some of that is just there's so much out there to experience and learn about. Why would we not?
You know?
I don't know. I don't have a great answer to that question.
No, I think you're nailing it. You know, obviously necessity is the mother of all innovation, but like there's a through line for a lot of people that end up in Southeast Asia, I feel like, where they're like adventuring around out there and like, oh my gosh, there's so much world. There's so many things to see.
Yeah.
Just like that culture. But then I think my mind is music. And a teacher, like you're, like you said, you're a genuinely curious person. Do you play multiple instruments?
Well, no, but I can.
Capable. Yeah.
Strings is my world.
So. Okay, cool. What's your favorite?
Favorite is cello.
Cello.
Though that's a secondary instrument for me. Classical guitar was my primary instrument for years and years and years. And I still love it. I still love any iteration of the guitar, whether that's a dobro or a classical or an electric. I don't care. I feel like it's one of the few instruments that is so intimate in the sense of it's literally what can you do with your fingers to make different sounds. I love it. There's nothing separating you from the implement that's producing a sound.
Cool.
But if I were to sit down and spend more time learning something, it'd be cello.
Nice.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful instrument. I think, creative, artistic people have high trait openness, you know, like they're open to things.
Oh, okay.
So it's like a psychological trait. Like you're kind of open-minded. You're like, I can go here. I can create.
Sure.
Like just the task of creating anything means that you're like, hey, what angle can I take here?
Okay.
So,
I think
that's probably a big part of it is just like, hey, there's something to be done. I'm going to go and do it. And I'm going to pursue a new angle because...
Right.
Yeah, maybe this song didn't sound good this way, but it sounds better this way. So,
right.
And I think you being a music teacher, probably you're uniquely tuned to be able to do that.
Maybe so. Good use of the word tuned, by the way.
Yeah.
There's probably something to that. And I mean, you've done the same thing, right? 20 years in the military, and then you pivot and go, okay, what comes next? And I mean, that in itself, very few people are in the military until they retire and just stop working for the rest of their life, right? But that transition must have required a lot of out-of-the-box thinking.
Yeah, it's been fun. I've gotten a lot of out of the box thinking. It's like the deployments, and I'm facing another deployment this year, mm-hmm. and it's just they teach you, and that's why I'm infinitely interested in the idea of resiliency. Because at 18, I joined the Army, and I small town kid from Conifer,
sure,
you know, up in the mountains there. It's like my you know, I played sports and all those things, but you don't develop this sense of resiliency mm-hmm. without having done some things, gone through some struggle and, you know, had those things illuminated for you. And mm-hmm. you're like you said, you know, sometimes you got to pivot and try something new. But the Army has a really good system of giving you structure.
Yeah.
But then there's challenge. And so through that challenge, I've been able to develop resiliency. And so I gravitate towards, I'm infinitely interested in people mm-hmm. every single day who are exhibiting some sort of resilience. Mm. And so that's why I was kind of drawn to you. But yeah, success is not a straight line. It's not linear.
Ever.
There's peaks and valleys. There's ebbs and flows to it. Sometimes it's just go, go, go. And like I said, I've got this deployment coming up and my phone was ringing off the hook this morning. And I'm like, that's so perfect. It's just like right when you're about to take off, the phone's ringing like crazy. And my wife and I were talking about that earlier. But cool. So when you came back to the United States, was there any adjustment period?
In what sense?
So, like, Asian culture versus American culture, back to American okay. living.
I laugh because the one thing that sticks out in my mind is the least consequential. It's I would walk on the left side of the sidewalk everywhere.
Okay.
It's like, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I also drove on the left side of the road, but that was easy to adjust to because either you adjust or you die. I bumped into a lot of people on sidewalks. Let's see. Adjustment. I think it was probably a lot easier than one would assume because of a few things. I was in this kind of insulated third culture where the people I was working with, most of them, I'm going to say like 70-80% of them also weren't from Malaysia.
Oh, okay.
So we weren't in our home culture. We weren't living day in and day out in Malaysian culture either. We were in this third thing. So nobody really feels 100%, like they can take things for granted. Right. Whereas you come back to the States and if you're like me, you spent most of your life there and you go, okay, well, it's muscle memory. It comes back. But there were bits and I've experienced this since then too, where I genuinely missed being able to speak in a language and knowing that people around me don't know what I'm saying.
Interesting.
Not that I'm talking about people or whatever. Yeah, no, I'm just fair. Like, hey, we need to go grocery shopping. Whatever. And I just don't want people listening to that. I don't know why. Maybe that's me being an introvert or something. I don't know. But I think the sidewalk and the language is probably the biggest bit. And then certainly, like, it's a life pivot. You go, okay, well, we're back in the States. Now all of the other things that we were planning, at least for the next coming years, are different, right? So you start over, you start life over and go, all right, what's important, what's not? What are we keeping that worked? What are we doing away with? That was not unique to Malaysia and the U.S., but that I do vividly remember those first couple months back in the States going, okay, this is starting over again. Because I wasn't going back to where we were. I wasn't going back to something I had never lived there before. Cool. Right.
That's very similar to military coming back from deployments or duty stations overseas, things like that. You're coming back to the United States and maybe you do separate out of the military and you're no longer in and you have to kind of reimagine yourself, reimagine your career or just kind of the community that you're in. So when you came back still in music or,
yep.
Teaching?
No, back up. I spent a year, the first year we got back, I was teaching middle school Spanish. It was a job that got us to where we wanted to be. And then one orchestra position was open in that entire school district the following year. And I kind of just hounded the, I forgot his title, curriculum developer, whatever it was, who was in charge of hiring that position. I literally would call him every 48 hours. Just be like, I want this one. I want this one. You don't have to hire me. You just have to move me from one position to the next within the district. And he gave it to me, and I stayed in music until I quit teaching after that.
Cool. No, that's good advice. Ironically enough, I just spoke with a woman this morning who's looking for a job as a, you know, she's trained in counseling. Okay. And she's looking for a counseling role in a various school district in the Denver metro area. And she's like, it's kind of a hard time right now because obviously the school year just ended.
Yep.
But I think what you just had to say is very interesting. It's just hound them, you know, squeaky wheel gets the grease.
Isn't that the truth?
And if you want the role, you're going to have to advocate for it.
So. Yeah. I mean, nobody's knocking down our doors going, hey, can we hire you?
Right? Yeah. Like, right.
Unless your name is Steve Jobs, was Steve Jobs. Oh, bad reference, David. But yeah, you just got to get over the ego of, yeah, I have to knock on doors and do it. Just do the thing.
Nice.
That's part of it.
But persistence.
Yeah.
And so now you're in a whole new role in the financial sector.
Yep.
And you need to be persistent and prospect and find new clients to serve and new relationships to develop.
Yep.
And you know, I think being in mortgage, you in the financial world, our industry's, you know,
are these adjacent things?
Yeah, adjacent, and we cross streams, and we must know each other, honestly, is my philosophy. I advise a lot of loan officers that I chat with, like, develop relationships with financial advisors. Mm-hmm. They're good people to know. What ultimately brought you to finance? Like, why of all things? Because, I mean, you're a talented, skilled, intelligent person. You could have gone in any industry. Why finance?
What I was looking for ultimately was something that kind of felt like education, or at the very least drew on the skills that I had developed in that world.
Cool.
Without being as emotionally invested in the day to day. I didn't want to wake up on a Saturday morning going, oh, I hope that kid is safe, you know, or what could I have done differently in that and this lesson? And like anybody who's talked to teachers in the past 10 years, I can't tell you anything you haven't heard already, but there's push and pull factors, right?
Yeah.
The push ones were the same as anybody would say. I not quite facetiously tell people, you can pay me poorly, treat me poorly, or ask me to work too much, but not all three of them. I'll probably do two of those, but not all three.
Yeah.
So I decided, well, I need to leave education then at that point. Actually, our good friend Dustin told me at one point, he goes, David, you've been doing this for 14 years. You've taught in three states and two different countries and whole bunches of schools. You got a lot of data points.
Right? Yeah.
Like, it's probably not going to change. So then the pull factors were, okay, let me find something, again, that feels like education or has this human element to it where I'm not ultimately the one responsible for somebody else's decision. Right. I'm talking to adults day in and day out, and a lot of my role is more like being a coach where I'm telling them, I'm going to hold your feet to the fire.
Cool.
You told me this was important. This was your goal. Here's how we get there. Let's talk about strategy. Let's talk about what are the tools we're going to implement. And at the end of the day, it's their future, not mine, right? Not that I don't care. I absolutely do. But it's different dealing with an adult than a 16-year-old, you know?
The ownership factor is different.
Yeah, well said.
Yeah, it's like when you're a kid, you kind of look to your teachers for the guidance. They're kind of taking that on. You have a certain degree of responsibility. But when we're older and we've got bills to pay and we're thinking about our assets and our liabilities and thinking about where we want to get in life, I think that's what's daunting about finance and mortgage both. I think those similarities is there's so much information out there.
Tons.
There's good information, there's bad information, and then there's, I guess for lack of a better term, misinformation.
Yep.
And I think I probably dispel myths on the daily with clients about you know, guidelines on mortgages, or what's allowable, what's not.
What are common ones that you hear?
Well, like, for instance, just earlier today, I was speaking with a veteran who wanted to buy another VA home loan. And there's so much misinformation about VA home loans. You can only use it once, or this, that, and the other thing. And there's ways to work through it. And, I was talking to him, and I'm a VA expert, not only because I've served, but also I've just done a lot of VA home loans, and I've dived into the guidelines, and my team, I think, is top notch as well. Sure. And so we find solutions to people's problems. And so that creates a ton of experience and a ton of understanding. Mm-hmm. And then same thing, can take an education and a coaching role and actually build a game plan for people.
Yeah.
And I joke all the time, the Army, the military as a whole, very good at teaching you a skill, giving you a job, telling you what to wear, when to eat, all those things, but they do not teach you how to build wealth. And so the VA home loan's a really good wealth generating mechanism for people. Obviously you need a roof over your head, but generating wealth is kind of where my head goes now at this stage in my career.
Is that one that people seem to underutilize, or is not as well known as it should be?
I think so. I mean, I most vets know of it.
Sure.
But then, like I said, I'll talk to vets where they're like, oh, I was waiting to use it because I didn't want to use it yet. Or, you know, just X, Y, or Z reason not to. But it's a phenomenal loan product. So I like educating around it.
Right. Well, and I asked because I genuinely had a client last week who was asking about that.
Yeah.
I
was like, there you go.
I don't know the answer, but I know who does.
That's perfect. So do you have like a, you know, without, obviously we've got constraints and we're not here to give very specific because everybody's financial portfolio and profile is different. Mm-hmm. But do you have kind of like a unique perspective because you've lived a unique life to investing? Is there anything that you look to for the standard American family of like, hey, start here, and this might be a unique way to approach it?
Yes and no. I think everybody's got a bit of a unique perspective just because, I mean, unless you're 23, just out of undergrad, and you have the same education that the three people next to you do, we've lived things, right?
Yeah.
So that gives every human a unique perspective. But genuinely, if folks are new to investing, planning their own finances, whatever, I honestly think the most effective first step, and it's the least glamorous, is to go and do their budget. And it, like, it's not a sexy date night. It's not, sometimes it leads to conflict.
Yeah.
Not that I would know anything about that, but go do your budget, and don't do it just for this current month or the past month, but do it for the last 3 months.
Okay.
And then average those 3 months out. That'll give you a better idea of what you're actually spending on a normal month, right? Because we always have outliers. December rolls around and we spend $720 more than we thought we would on gifts. But do your budget for the past 3 months, and then try to stick to, or try to get to, the 60-20-20 rule.
Okay. Elaborate.
So out of your entire monthly income, the general wisdom is 60% should be going to fixed expenses, right? Mortgage, car payment, whatever it might be. These things are the same date, same amount, same vendor every month. Then 20% should be going towards discretionary things like your date with your significant other, the weekend trip to wherever, coffee on the way into work, like things that make life enjoyable.
Yeah.
And then the other 20% should be going towards your financial goals, whether that is saving for retirement through your employer-sponsored plan or putting money aside for your kid's college or whatever your goal might be, whatever those specifics are.
Okay.
Most folks need to save about 20%, give or take, of their take-home pay, right? So my first bit of advice is go do your budget and try to get as close to that 60-20-20 as possible. Second bit is take advantage of all the resources that you have at your fingertips already. And most folks do. fortunately, most employers give really good benefits, or at least mediocre benefits, but we don't have
some benefit, right?
We don't have to pay for them. So that's something that can protect us. That isn't coming out of our pocket, or if it is, it's usually pretty economical. Most employers offer a retirement plan, which we don't think of it as the employee, but that means that we're investing, right? If my employer gives me a 3% match option, take them up on that every single time. That's free money. I don't care if that's a 401k, a 403b, an IRA, whatever it is. If it's free money, take the free money, right? And then beyond that, I would say have a list of your goals and a timeline. So do your budget, take advantage of the resources you've got already, then list out your goals and your timeline. For a lot of my clients, those goals look like, hey, in 2 years, I want to put a down payment on a home. I don't have the cash right now, but I know in a couple of years I want to, right?
Okay.
Or in 12 years, my kid's going to be 18. I want to pay for their college or whatever comes after high school, right? Let's be honest. Who knows? Who knows? But I want to have something to give them for when that comes. And then 25 years down the road, I want to retire. If you have your budget, you know what you have available to you, and you have your goals and a rough timeline of them, you're ahead of most people already.
Cool.
Take those to a financial advisor. They will automatically have 17 different ideas for you, if they're worth their metal. But those are kind of the least glamorous and most effective first steps. If we get more into the details and the weeds, going back to that 60-20-20, within your 20%, look at what are you already putting aside for your financial goals. Let's say I've got a 401k and that 3% match. Great. So now I've got 17% that I need to allocate essentially monthly. If I'm saving towards my kids' education and putting 100, 200 bucks away, that might be another 1% that I'm putting away. And kind of work through what you're already doing. Then, of course, the remainder of, you know, whatever that 20% was, let's say it's $1,000 is my 20% figure. If I'm already putting 500 bucks away towards things that I don't think about on a monthly basis, 500 is what I've got left. Take that number then to a financial advisor, say, I've got 500 to work with. Here's my goals. What do I do? Right. You had mentioned earlier Roth options, right? Like if we can all open up a Roth account, open up a Roth account.
Yeah.
This is a powerful tool that we have available, right? If you don't know you have it available, go talk to HR. They will know right away. But those are the really down and dirty, not glamorous, but very effective first steps.
Nice.
For sure.
I like that. It's actionable. And those three buckets are, it gives the math behind it, right? The 60-20-20, I love that rule. That's actionable for everybody. And then it kind of gives you that framework. And that's kind of the goal of the podcast is I'm always, through conversation, trying to give little frameworks, little tidbits of information for people. So that's perfect. I like that a lot. The American dream is, in my estimation, very much alive.
Mm-hmm.
It is a thing. The promise that is upward mobility, if you do a couple of these things or you take these steps. And I think what you said was incredibly coherent. I want to save for my kids. One of the best reasons there possibly could be, in my estimation, is like saving for your family, for your kids, for their futures. Absolutely.
Right.
To enjoy your life, the finer aspects, having disposable income to, like you said, go out on date nights with a significant other. I think everybody wants that.
Right.
And then retirement. I think retirement one day to be able to kind of, you know, go into that phase of life knowing that you're taken care of is a part of that American dream. And that is something that we absolutely need to talk about. Obviously, there's Social Security. There's other kind of safety net options. Mm-hmm. But to lean solely on Social Security, we read the news every day. Having something squirreled away is really good. And I like it too. I think the misconception that I need to do a ton of saving, like just start today with whatever you can.
Well said.
Whatever that may be.
And I mean, there's plenty of studies out there that show that the single biggest determining factor in investors who do well long term versus those who don't isn't necessarily asset allocation or what they're trading on a day-to-day basis. It's how long they're invested in the market.
Yep.
Right. So if we look at the last 100 years just in the US stock market, there, for example, has never been a 15-year period where a dollar invested doesn't earn.
Okay.
Granted, there's no guarantees in investment. So sure. We can't say that means it won't happen, but it hasn't happened in the last century. So, I mean, even if we look at a period of 1926 to 1941, well, we know we had the stock market crash in 29, but even those dollars invested in 26 would have earned prior to 41, right?
Okay.
So if we can leave money in the market and not touch it, not take it out, I'm not saying don't trade it, I'm not saying don't sell, don't buy, whatever, but if we can keep it invested for longer periods of time, chances of us earning what we want to earn are much higher.
Yeah.
So a lot of what I do and the other team members I work with do is kind of coaching again, right? Cool. It's behavior coaching. It's especially in 2025 when folks are like calling us at 8 a.m. on a Monday going, sell everything. I want cash right now because we're all anxious. We say, okay, I understand the anxiety. Sorry that's happening to you. Here's what we should do.
Yeah, can we buffer this volatility through some other mechanism?
And the answer is usually yes.
Yeah.
But it takes a little bit of emotional distance. It takes us being able to look at numbers on a screen and saying, I'm not emotionally invested in these numbers to the degree that my client is, obviously, because it's their retirement we're talking about. We take it seriously, but we can put distance between us and that decision that we make so that it actually works out better for the client.
Yeah.
Whereas if we're sitting at home on our couch trading day in and day out, we're going to be stressed.
Yeah.
To the nines.
Day trading's a lot too. that's so much. One of my the starkest contrast, and one thing that my favorite aspect of COVID was 2020, 2021, gotcha. COVID years, the saving rate for the average American mm-hmm. family actually increased. It's and it was good. Looking super encouraging. Uh-huh. People were putting money away. Uh-huh. We were spending less.
Uh-huh.
And then now in 2025, you look at consumer credit card debt, consumer debt in general, we've now re-levered ourselves, and then that savings rate has fallen.
Yep.
And yep. So I like what you had to say. Just to set that budget and identify where all the dollars are going, mm-hmm. is there anywhere we can save
right.
as opposed to letting the dollars walk out the door?
Right, or at least be aware of what you are spending, right? Now we don't need to go down that rabbit hole, but there's often, you know, we think we're spending $700 a month on groceries. Turns out it's probably more like $850 or $900, which is not a bad thing. I'm not judging one way or the other, but to have eyes on that and to yeah. know on average, I'm actually spending XYZ instead of ABC. That's really powerful. And if you know that your budget actually is this amount versus what you had in your brain beforehand, great. Then what's left over, you can go out and do what you want to do with, right? Reliably.
Yeah.
And that's another, I mean, again, investors who have more success long-term are the ones who are investing consistently, right? Okay. They're not putting in $100,000 one year and hoping they make another 120 in the coming 2 years, and then they're going to invest that lump sum. They're a lot less glamorous and more methodical about it,
yeah.
right? So let's figure out what the amount is and then do it periodically on a regular basis. If for nothing else, that builds up the savings muscle to where it doesn't hurt as cool. much every time. We're not dreading, oh yeah, next year I got to put in another $50,000.
Yeah. The anxiety around investing and saving for many families, I'm sure is very high right now. It's in my job description to read the data, the CPI, mm-hmm. you know, all those mm-hmm. kinds of things and seeing, and there's a very real difference in the, you know, CPI factors such as food at home mm-hmm. versus food away, you know, yep. takeout, you know, going out to restaurants.
Yeah.
Those aren't the same inflation rate. And I think when we turn the news on every day, everybody's like, everything's inflated. And we all feel it. Everybody feels it. But there's different percentages to mm-hmm. those inflationary mm-hmm. inputs. the cost of food. And honestly, you know, eating at home can be nice, and cooking with your significant other or by yourself or whatever it may be, it can be a lot of fun. But there are ways we can save and still feel like you're getting the most out of life and and living that rich, full life that we all want to live.
That's what I always tell my clients too, is like, look, I want you to go out and enjoy what you're doing. I want, like, God forbid something were to happen today and you were miserable for 10 years, but you were saving really aggressively for that boat in retirement and then you get hit by a bus and you're gone. Like, what were those 10 years for? Right. That's not the idea. We want to balance what we're doing today with what you want for the future. People get really strict with themselves when it comes to their goals for other people, like our kids. Right.
Oh, okay.
We don't tend to get as strict with ourselves of, yeah, but I want that in retirement too, right? So we go, but I want that other monthly subscription this time. Yeah. You
know? It's a double-edged sword too, because I'm an elder millennial, and we saw our parents and our grandparents' generations work, worked for the same company for 40 years and got a pension, and we all know those things are very rare nowadays. Mm-hmm. But a younger generation is now more experience-driven, where it's like, go to Southeast Asia and adventure around on a motorcycle through Vietnam. You know, like, you hear about that a lot. And you can kind of see it in the data of young people are choosing experience over things, which psychologically, you know, we can talk about that for hours on those differences. But if you're putting it on credit at your expense, you're basically mortgaging your future for today's experience, and so things like that. So do you ever have conversations with people about saving for experiences?
Yeah,
for
all the time.
Cool.
All the time. So a real common one, you know, like, let's take a real generic example of, like, 3 years from now, I want to take, this is actually me, I want to take my family to the Grand Canyon. We've never been, right? Okay. So instead of squirreling away my money in, I'm not going to name banks, but in whatever the big bank accounts are that are giving us 0.1, 0.35% interest, why would I not put that somewhere else that can at least keep pace with inflation, right? So I might as well look at the money market. I might as well look at brokerage accounts. I might as well look at these other things so that 3 years from now, the $2,000 that I saved still feels like $2,000. It doesn't feel like 1,500, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, those are common conversations. Great. And those are the fun ones to save for anyways, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's not immediate gratification, but it's not all that delayed either. It's right around the corner.
Yeah.
So those are the fun ones that people want to talk about. And sometimes don't want to talk about. They're like, oh, I feel bad saying this, but no, don't feel bad. You're a human who lives in the real world. Of course you want those things.
Yeah.
Let's figure out how to make it efficient. Let's figure out how to get you there.
Well, when you look back on your entire life, obviously there's all of our experiences as adults, but man, when I think back on my childhood, that family vacation, and like I said, I've got four siblings, so we're a family of seven. When I think about my first 18 years of life, immediately with little to no effort, I can think about those just meaningful vacations that we took. And even simple ones, like we drove into the Midwest. We drove to Wisconsin once as a family in the minivan.
Scenic route.
Yep. But my parents needed capital in order to do that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so they had to save for those experiences. But now as an adult, I look back on those time with my siblings like, man, that was a good trip.
Yeah,
that
right?
That was a ton of fun.
Absolutely. We did the road trips to Wisconsin too. I was 15 when we were driving back from Wisconsin, and I was in the driver's seat, and the van that I was driving caught on fire in like Sydney, Nebraska. And the three or four in the back were asleep. My mother was right next to me. She noticed and I didn't. And she touched my forearm and goes, David, as soon as it's safe and as fast as you can without pushing it, I need you to pull over to the shoulder of the highway.
Cool.
And I'm kind of like, okay, cool. Why? Like, yes, I will. And why? What's going on? And we popped the hood and sure enough, there's fire.
Your mom sounds real calm, cool, and collected.
Yeah, yeah, she is. Fortunately, because I probably would have been like, pull over now.
Yeah, we're on fire. Change lanes, we're on fire.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Especially because you're 15. But those, yeah, fire aside, I digress. Those types of trips are
that's awesome.
Typical of what we all want, right? We want our families to remember those moments. We want our families to go, oh yeah, we were able to do X, Y, Z, and we remember it 30 years later.
Did you guys ever go out to Lake McConaughey?
Oh yeah,
Nebraska.
Oh yeah,
that's a fun trip,
right?
Camping on the beach,
just getting sunburnt to hell.
Yeah.
I love it. I love it.
It's so funny. Like I was just up in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho last week, and the lake is just gorgeous, ton of water. And I always say, Colorado, the only thing Colorado is missing is water. We've got it all, but no like real, real big bodies of water.
What is Coeur d'Alene like? I've heard good things.
Oh, highly impressed. I had never been. I've been through other parts of Idaho, but I hadn't been up to Coeur d'Alene. That lake is phenomenal. You're just, I mean, here in Colorado or the Denver Metro, it's like, obviously we've got the mountains and a lot of green up there. Uh-huh. But the whole town's just shrouded in woods. And then you've got the lake and real small town feel, people riding bikes everywhere. And it was Memorial Day weekend and it wasn't crazy busy.
Really?
Yeah, it was, you know, we got into any restaurant we wanted to.
Do you think that's because it's so far out of the way?
Maybe. But honestly, it was pretty easy. We flew into Spokane, Washington.
Oh, of course.
And it was like an hour drive over from Spokane.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So I'm impressed. I will go back 10 out of 10. Nice. Will recommend.
Good to know. Good to
know. We rented a boat one day, got out on the water, and there wasn't a ton of boats. It was fun. Obviously, the water's probably a little cold Memorial Day weekend.
Sure, but what do you expect?
I'd be curious to go back on 4th of July and see how crazy it is.
Yeah,
so I bet. It might be warmer then. But
man, for good scenery, that's I'll take cold water any day.
Yeah, mountains. You are a lover of the mountains, like you said earlier, ski, and I mentioned it, Colorado Trail. Mm-hmm. When did you thru-hike the Colorado Trail?
2012.
Cool.
Yeah, that was a goal I had set for myself in my early, mid-20s. It said, sometime in the next 3 years, I'm going to do it.
Right? Cool.
And I planned it all out, and as you know, some things go to plan and some don't.
Yeah.
And man, it was a trip. It was a trip and a half. I was lucky enough to have folks kind of meet me along the way. Some would hike with me for 2 days, 5 days, whatever it was, and then you know, we'd drive back to or hitchhike back to wherever their car was, and then I'd hitchhike back to where I had been or however the logistics worked out. But yeah, spent. Now that I remember, there was a stretch, I don't know, 70, 80, 90 mile stretch there that was closed for downed trees, which, whatever, it's the real world. So I had to come back and do that stretch. I don't know how many years later, a year, two, 3 years later. But the rest of it
nice.
In about 4 weeks, I think.
Cool. Yeah. Sounds about on par. Denver to Durango or Durango to Denver?
Denver to Durango.
Nice.
Yeah. I didn't want to mess with early season snow in Durango.
Yeah. The San Juans, they'll get you.
Is that the direction you went to?
Yeah. Denver to Durango. Took off out there in Waterton Canyon and my parents picked me up in Durango. And
nice.
But on the bike, it's a lot faster. So 9 days.
Yeah. That's got to be intense.
It was. It was super intense, but I had a lot of motivation. I had just quit drinking.
Okay.
Went through a divorce.
Yep.
Sold my house. Quit my job. And there's took motivation. To the trail.
Any one of those things.
Yeah. So that was all of it.
Good on you.
But and I joke all the time that the Colorado Trail is a hiking trail that people elect to bike.
Yeah.
What was it like hiking it? 4 weeks? That's awesome.
Yeah. It was wonderful. Like, it's simple, right? It's in the really, like in the sense that you don't have to do much. Hmm. You have to wake up, walk, and go to sleep, and you should get as many calories as you can in the meantime.
Calories, water, yeah.
Yeah, like that's all you have to do. So your mind has 15, 20 hours a day to wander and do whatever it needs to do or wants to do. I love that simplicity. I love it. I had a tradition for a long time of at the end of every academic year when I was done teaching, I would go and spend 3 to 5 or 6 days alone in the mountains, right? Mm. And for that reason, just I don't have to do anything other than that, and my mind can go.
Cool.
But for 4 weeks on end, it takes a different, or it has kind of a different dynamic to it, right? I went in it with a specific goal, and I thought at 27 years old, this is me. I think I had moved back to Colorado from DC recently, and it was like, sweet, I'm gonna get to know my state, and this is like me,
yeah,
right? Nice. Like this romantic, the River Y type thing. It wasn't that at all, in a good sense. It was, I feel like I ended up thinking, you know, it doesn't matter how well I know Colorado or not. Like the people in my life are a heck of a lot more important to me than that. Like,
interesting.
I won't remember what Snow Mesa looks like 30 years from now, but I'll remember walking through there with Harry, you know. I'll remember,
oh, cool.
I'll remember how cold he was. He's my brother-in-law. He's from East Texas. I love him dearly. I'll remember those things more than anything specifically about Colorado or the mountains where I grew up or whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
So, you know, I entered with one idea as a 27-year-old and left with a different one. And I was like, oh, that wasn't what I thought. And it was better. It was better than what I thought.
Cool. Did you have a favorite section or segment?
Yeah, the last one. The last one. Just like going from Lake City into Durango.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a few places on earth that I've seen that are that beautiful, right?
San Juans, man.
Yeah. It's just so gorgeous. So gorgeous. That one stands out. The Collegiate Mountains are.
I'd agree. Yeah.
They're like a study in contrast because it's so arid at the foot of the mountains and then so very different. Know 500 feet elevation gain above it.
So
those ones stand out in my mind, though favorite might not be the right word.
Yeah, no, that's cool. I mean, I full agreement, the San Juans from Moles Pass, and then you're kind of like, you see the end in sight too, so there's that.
Yeah,
but yeah, sure. The wildflowers down in the San Juans in those last few segments are legendary.
Yep. Squaw Pass, that one spot.
Yeah.
That maybe I take back my former statement. I will remember that one.
That's good, yeah. Black Hawk down there right before you get to Durango. It's as green as can be, mm-hmm. and then the dirt's red,
yep.
and just that juxtaposition
looks
so cool.
Yep. Yeah. Man, I love it. I love it. How many miles a day were you doing in 9 days? That's
some days were longer, some days were shorter, but you're looking at like, what is it, 60... 60-ish, 60, 70. Some days were longer, like on the wilderness reroutes. So we can't go through the wilderness areas on a bike.
Right.
So then like there's like right around the Collegiates, mm-hmm. There's the Collegiate Peaks Wilderness reroute or the various other ones. But, you know, getting to Mount Princeton Hot Springs there and getting a shower
right.
and going to that little shop
heaven.
There and getting stuff. Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
Nice. Were you in a good place? Place mentally and in life when you took to the trail, or were you kind of in like a weird transitionary period?
Yeah, good question. It was a transitionary period in that like I was newly married, but it was a good place.
Cool.
I think I had moved back the previous year from Washington DC, and so there's certainly transition of like back in Colorado. Husband for the first time. And like, there's nothing wrong, nothing going cool. on necessarily. Fortunately that came later, but yeah, it was a good, like, this is a thing that I've always wanted to do and I'm just going to do it.
Fantastic. You know? Yeah. Cause the experiences vary. Even when you're on trail and you encounter other people,
yeah.
everybody had a reason for being out on the trail.
100%.
Not all of them were just because it's a goal and I want to do. Some people
right.
were walking things off.
Yep.
You see a lot of that. The healing power that is endurance and yep. the woods, nature. For me, that was a big part of it, was like walking off some effects of the war. Obviously, my marriage falling apart.
Right.
That was in shambles. And so I had a lot of things to contemplate and work through on the trail. So that was super effective. And the reason I asked that question is because I think it's so interesting hearing everybody's different perspectives, because, and I've done some other big, long bike packs too, where life is just cruising along. Everything's great. Mm-hmm. Relationships are great. Family's great. Everything's great. It's a little harder in my estimation to like want to suffer too much.
Yeah.
But when my life is in shambles, mm-hmm. you can suffer all day
You're
long.
Already suffering, right? You might as well suffer in the mountains.
Yeah. It's and like I would say, I down there in Sergeant's Mesa. So after, you know, Poncha Springs, and you get into Sergeant's Mesa before you get to Lake City and the San Juans, mm-hmm. it's a pretty remote section. And I left a piece of me, a dead, useless, old piece of me. Mm-hmm. I left it out there to die out in the woods. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you grow past that.
Yeah. Yeah. A dear friend of mine lost his sister 17 years ago. And then when a mutual friend of ours lost his, they were talking about grief, and he goes, look, everybody says time heals all wounds, but that's bullshit. Forgive me. That's not true. What it is like having an amputated limb, and you just learn how to live without it.
Huh.
Like, it doesn't get better. You just learn skills that you didn't have beforehand.
Interesting.
Right? Or you adapt. And yeah, I feel like being in the mountains is good for that, right? Like, there's something that needs to have its time, be done, be put to rest, and then we move on. Maybe something takes its place, maybe something doesn't, but that's for each person to find out and decide on their own, right? Hiking, biking is good for that.
It was fun, and this might be interesting to other people, maybe it's not, but I came up with three kind of realizations while I was on the trail, and you'll kind of get these because you saw it so much. The first one is you'll be walking down, or you'll be walking or riding down the trail, and you'll see just enormous, beautiful, huge pines.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see these tiny little trees trying to grow in the shade of a big tree.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, you know what? That's a good lesson for life. Like, don't try and grow in somebody else's shade. Grow in your own sunlight.
Yeah, I like it.
All the trees that were in their own sunlight,
mm-hmm.
taken off and growing, mm-hmm. doing their thing. So I was like, okay, that's a good lesson for life.
Sure.
And then you'll keep walking on or riding on, and then you'll see a downed tree,
uh-huh.
a big old tree that fell because uh-huh. there was a creek and there was all this surface level water, and it didn't send its roots deep. Mm-hmm. It only sent its roots out horizontally because it had plenty of water, right. and it just grew up, and then a stiff wind blew it over.
Mm-hmm.
So I think about that all the time too, where, grow your roots deep and not too shallow.
Yeah.
A stiff wind doesn't want to blow you over. Like, and then every one of those mountains was comprised of rock, and the trail meandered its own way. And but life is, you know, there's always similar rocks to, you know, kind of encounter. It's like, mm-hmm. there's always going to be something you got to get up and over.
Mm-hmm.
The trail has to go around this, that, or the other mm-hmm. thing. And not to ever take it too personally that, like you said, there was a bunch of downed trees or, mm-hmm. you know, whatever the obstacle was. And so I just got kind of accustomed to just accepting the obstacles and the rocks in the way.
And that's so, what it's about.
Yeah. So I feel like the trail teaches you life. And absolutely. Not that you're asking for it to do that. It just
But it will.
Does.
Yep. Yeah. And I feel like putting ourselves in a situation where we're small has that potential, and that's really healthy for us, I think. I'm no psychologist, but let it teach you something, because we're ultimately not in control out there.
No.
And you'll learn that pretty quick.
I can't remember the stat, but there's a certain percentage or amount of miles, both, where you're above tree line.
I don't know.
Yeah, there's
it seems like a lot.
A lot. There's definitely a lot.
Especially in that southwest corner there.
Yeah.
I think there was a good two and a half days that I was above tree line there. I was a slow walker. But yeah, there's a lot of it. That's kind of an eerie feeling, no?
It is, yeah. When those afternoon thunderstorms roll in and you're mm-hmm. like above tree line, you're like, where's my cover?
Mm-hmm.
None.
Yep. So. Yep. It's on your back. Yeah. That's where it is.
How many miles a day were you walking?
Same. It depended on the day, depending on how hard the miles were. I think on easy days, 18 to 22, 3, 4 cool. miles, something like that. On the harder terrain, 13, 14, 15, 16. Nice. But that totally depends on
yeah. what
gets thrown your way, right?
Obviously. Any effects from it?
Yeah, yeah. My knees have not recovered still X number of years later. I vividly remember the next ski season. Just going, oh, this is what all the old timers were talking about. This, and they're kind of like, no, it's not, David. It's coming yet. It's coming.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't recover as fast as I used to. And that's fine. It was worth it.
Your knees have a story now.
Right, right. There's a reason they click and clack.
Yeah. My buddy did the PCT in 5 months, and he's like, my feet are permanently altered from it.
Really?
And I mentioned the long bike packs that I've done. I did the Continental Divide, the CDT, or the Great Divide mountain bike route, which follows right there. But okay. my hands are permanently altered.
How so? They get colder. I know very little about biking. Okay.
Just like I don't know if it's like nerve damage, but some exposure, some just repetitive gripping the handlebar for so long.
Okay.
But now, growing up, my hands never got cold, but now they get cold.
Okay. My wife is real into mountain biking, and I know nothing of it. Like, she could be speaking Greek to me. I don't get it. It's whatever. But that's the thing I would not... I feel like that's a detail that unless you do it, you don't know. Whereas I'm like... your hands, but you're using your legs, right?
Yeah. Just pressure. Mm. And just being on those, what is it? The ulnar nerve or whatever it is. But yeah, it kind of altered. I'm glad to know that your wife, mountain bikes, there's been I followed the mountain biking scene, the climbers. Okay. Road riding and mountain bike, Columbia has produced some really good climbers.
Yeah, yeah.
They've got some mountains down there.
One of our favorite restaurants where we were at for the past few years is called, what is it? El Finca de Rigo. It's this cyclist from down there who's just this tiny, tiny little guy from the south of Columbia.
Yep.
But he is a national treasure down there.
Cool.
He made it to the international level, and it's a, like you mentioned, it really, really developed biking culture, both road and mountain biking, but he's their guy. He, nice. Whatever. So what he did was like come back to Colombia and open up a bunch of restaurants, and man, if it's not wonderful food, but
Colombian food, what's quintessential Colombian food?
Depends on where you're at. We lived in the mountains there, and it's like everything's a mix of salty and sweet. And often the sweet comes from bananas and plantains.
Plantains.
Mm-hmm. And the salt, like the quintessential, is chicharrones. So,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, a lot of fried pork and plantains.
Sounds wonderful.
With soups, they do really great soups.
Colombia is definitely on my list. I'd like to get down there.
Why?
The food, I'm just a sucker for mountains.
Yeah.
Just that Spanish influence. I don't know.
Dude, so many great places to see. So many great places to see. If I weren't in Colorado, I'd want to be there.
So cool. So then your wife is from Colombia. Mm-hmm. You guys get down there much?
Still, I mean, we just moved back last year, so the idea is to go back every year or two.
Cool.
But we haven't been back yet.
Nice. Well, I'm sure it's on the calendar soon.
Yeah, yeah. We need to make it happen for sure. We don't want our daughter was born down there, and we don't want her to not know her family down there.
So. Oh, perfect. So. And a really cool aspect to her is that she is a Colombian Air Force veteran. So she that's is. Right up my alley.
She is. She's a badass.
Nice. You know, what does she do in the Air Force?
Logistics. So she was in charge of logistics on base.
Okay.
She was on, if you listen to this, forgive me, I forgot the number of how many bases she was on. A lot of different bases.
Nice, say generically. Naturally.
And did a bunch of logistics for ceremonies, international events, day-to-day stuff, and their whatever it was.
That's super cool.
Yep.
Yeah, I always find it interesting. I think now as I get to 22 years of service, I've encountered militaries from so many other different countries. And mm-hmm. I've worked with military in Panama and Belize and guys down there, and then a lot of countries in the Middle East and Asia. Okay. And it's been fun seeing like that desire to serve in the military is, I think, similar to so many countries. Just how we utilize it obviously is a little bit different.
Sure.
But just, I think the military is a super cool place to gain some life experience and that do that role. And obviously Colombia's got a Army and Air Force and all those other things, same as us. So right. I think it's super cool to encounter people that served in other nations' militaries.
No kidding. I imagine there's a Venn diagram of shared experiences, huh?
Oh, yeah.
When you say the desire to serve in the military, how does that show up? I'm not a vet, so I don't have that perspective, but what do you see amongst other countries in their service people?
I think pride in their country, obviously national pride. You can go into the private sector, you can go do good things, you can do a bunch of, there's endless opportunity. But to go serve in Colombia's Air Force, I'm sure your wife has a great deal of pride in Colombia. Mm-hmm. And it's just the maximal place for that.
Sure.
Regardless of where you came from, you can all join the organization and serve and then help one another. Sure. I think that's a really cool through line, and which is why it's fun doing VA home loans. I was on a call with a vet last week, and we had never served together.
Huh.
He was just referred to me, and he did 16 years in the infantry. Oh, wow. And by the end of the call, it's like we were in the same platoon together.
I bet.
There's just a pretty low bar. It's like where you've got enough shared experiences, like you did this thing or you went to that place or, and you can just like break through that initial, meeting a new person. And I feel like by the end of the call, we already know each other. All right, let's get you into a home.
Yeah. Fun. Well, how cool too, to be able to genuinely in such a tangible way, help somebody get a home, right? Like basic necessities. It's funny you say a low bar. To me, at least in the US, it seems like a high bar, quite frankly, because like what percentage of our population serves?
I think it's like under 1%, 1% maybe.
So there's not many of you, right? And it's not like that's an easy thing to do. It's not.
No, I mean, we were at war for 20 years. I mean, I guess we're always at war, so we're creating veterans every day. But
That's true.
It's fun. There's just that shared camaraderie. And I had heard recently, like, a byproduct of doing hard things with one another is oxytocin. Oxytocin bonds us.
Mm-hmm. Trauma, like, bonding?
Yeah, we bond with our children via oxytocin. And I think when you're, on a long field exercise or on a deployment or something like that, trauma bonding is like the common vernacular, but like the chemical aspect of it is just like the oxytocin that we all developed together.
Sure.
And I had a barbecue at the house, and a lot of old Army buddies that I've served with were over at the house this weekend. And it's just like, man, you're not my blood, but man, you're a brother to me for sure. It's fun.
One of my closest friends in the world is a Marine, and that's the same thing with him. He's like, we will punch each other in the face and fight over everything, but nobody else gets to do that.
Yeah.
Like, you cannot do that to that guy.
Yeah.
Like, all right. Fair enough.
Not you're my asshole.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like nobody gets to talk shit about you but me. Yeah. The Marines are a special breed, too.
Special is a word for it.
Yeah. Well, because Veterans Day is November 11th every year, mm-hmm. and the Marine birthday is November 10th. Mm-hmm. And the Marines love to party on the 10th.
Mm-hmm.
And the it's ninth, just
and
fun.
The
8th
and the 7th and the 6th. Yeah.
But Yeah, and the Marines are so underfunded, and they, just kind of suffer out in the field together. And those guys are hilarious.
They are. They're good humans. I every single one of my good friend and all of his Marine buddies, whether they serve together or not, like every single one of them, I'll hang out with them and be like, "Yep, I I see why you guys stick to each other.
Yeah.
You know, you got a good thing going here and just really good human beings.
If you're in any room, you'll find the vegan, the CrossFitter, or the military veteran.
And in Denver, probably we find two each CrossFitters. Other.
It's just like, oh, let me tell you about this. Or yeah. I guess the new thing now is High Rocks. So
what's that?
It's like CrossFit, but it's fast exercising.
Oh, I like slow things.
Yeah.
Okay, I've never heard that.
Yeah, one. Check right, out High Rocks. It's this new up and coming thing. But I think also too, I think that's why you're seeing this proliferation, but like popularity of run clubs and all these other things. Mm. I think a lot of people in our culture right now are looking for that thing that binds us together.
Yeah.
That thing that we can kind of share, suffer through, right, and like, and do that. And maybe that's a byproduct of our digital age or, modernity, you know, it's just like everything.
COVID.
We're seeking connection. We're seeking community. Mm-hmm. And I think that's phenomenal.
Yeah. This
is opt for that at all times.
Trend. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 100%. And it's healthy.
Right. Worst case scenario, you go get some exercise, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, definitely. And you said you like to ski?
I do, yeah. It's one of my favorite things in the world.
Nice.
I haven't done it in a few years, but I need to get back.
Yeah.
Back onto the ski.
Scaling business. It's a fine line of like doing the BD, the business development, and mm-hmm. then also doing the things that make you great. Why mm-hmm. your spouse was attracted to you in the first place, why people are attracted to you in general. It's
yeah.
like going out and pursuing those.
Still being yourself.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, 100%. We talk a lot about like financial advisors in particular. We are a dime a dozen, man. There's so many of us. It's crazy. And there's all these different hypotheses of you should have a niche, you shouldn't have a niche, you should go after XYZ type of clientele, you shouldn't, you should take anybody who fogs a mirror. And at the end of the day, you're kind of like, I want to help people, you know?
Yeah.
Let me help people go to work and then leave work at work and be myself.
Cool.
And that feels like a good balance.
Have you contemplated that though? Sitting down and like finding your ideal client where you probably spend a lot of your time with that yeah. type of person or that or a specific community. Not sure. not to typecast it, like you sure. said, a niche. Like
sure.
But like is there a community that you just really love to really help out?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. There's two or three that come to mind. And on my team I tend to be the guy who, like I think I told you, I specifically focus on sustainable and equitable solutions, right?
Okay.
So as long as money is out of our hands, what is it supporting out in the world? Whether that's climate change, companies with very diverse boards of directors, people working in healthcare, whatever it might be, is that money supporting some kind of other cause out in the world? That's kind of my role within our team, but kind of unexpectedly, the people I work most with are either career changers, which seemed
you got like credibility.
Looking back on it, like it's just a natural fit, right? Career changers and or self-employed folks who are going, hey, I don't have HR telling me what my benefits are,
okay, cool.
right? So what do I do? How can I save for retirement on my own? And then the other one is like pre-retirees, 5 to 10 years out. Going, hey, I want to retire young, but I'm not sure if I can do that.
Or if I'm ready, or yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Or let's redefine retirement and say, okay, let's call retirement that moment when you no longer have to work. You get to decide, do you want to keep working just because you like it, or pick something else up? And if it doesn't make money, great, that's fine. but those are kind of my two biggest portions of my clientele currently. But what I tell people really is like, I'll work with anybody who's genuinely motivated to work on their finances. And I'm looking for people who also care about something sustainable and equitable, right?
Okay.
If you care about what your money is supporting out in the world, then unfortunately, a lot of advisors aren't talking about that. They're not going to ask the question of like, hey, what's important to you in your portfolio other than the numbers?
Mm.
But those are the conversations I like.
Yeah. You can do a lot of good out in the world. There's a ton of good to be done. You can have passion projects. You can believe in X, Y, or Z thing. But at the end of the day, you need capital to further a mission. Mm-hmm. I do, you know, near and dear to my heart are veteran organizations and veteran nonprofits and things like that. And so I think it got to be like a dirty word for a while where capital and the acquisition of capital can be a very good thing. Mm-hmm. And sometimes a nonprofit does absolutely need to run with a business prerogative, with a motive to grow capital, find new streams of it, and do all the things. And so, we can all be Mother Teresa.
Sure.
For sure. But we also need, Mother Teresa still needed capital to buy the rice and beans to feed the masses.
Right, right.
So,
and if we look on a macro scale, wherever we fall on a political spectrum, if we want to do right by other people, however we think that's going to happen, it needs to be scalable. Right? So I listened to this interview with an investor who was talking about Red Cliff Labs in India, speaking of Mother Teresa. And this is a company who saw a problem in this country with 1.4 billion people in it, in healthcare. And they said, look, people have trouble getting to diagnostics. And they have to take hours out of their workday to go get a test done. They have to wait in line to get the thing done. They have to go home, wait another 2 or 3 weeks to get the results. Somebody calls them and they get whatever, right? This also sounds like a lot of developed countries. But what they did was they implemented this system where essentially they have drivers go to those patients within an hour, say, great, we can do your test in home. We'll drive it back to the lab. Within 3 hours, you've got your results.
Cool.
And then you can move on to treatment, to whatever you need to do. What that's done is then give people access to healthcare that they didn't have because they couldn't take time off of work. It's saved India as a country about $400 million annually. And they're raking in wealth, right?
Yeah.
Like they're the company, their investors. Yeah, they're making a profit off of it. And it's making things better for their consumers, right?
So absolutely.
So on a large scale, my opinion is that we need to be looking for companies that are innovative. We need to be looking for companies that are doing something outside of the box. We need to be looking for how is this, yes, meeting a need and helping people and scalable and sustainable in a business sense, right? But that takes research. That takes time to find.
Yeah. We can walk and chew gum. I think scalability and the desire for human flourishment can... You know, they're not mutually exclusive.
Right.
You can do two things at the same time.
Right.
And, you know, maybe it got kind of out of vogue for a little while where we just want to lead with our hearts, which, yeah, sure. You know, everybody wants to. Everybody wants human flourishment. Mm-hmm. But like developing nations, access to clean water, early detection of disease and various other maladies. We got to find those things and find those opportunities. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, the cream rises to the top. The companies that are doing good work in those localities are going to increase market share and continue to do the thing. So, yeah, you know, not to opine on capitalism, but I'm a capitalist through and through. And I think in order to do good in this world, I need capital.
Yep.
I need dollars to serve people.
Yeah. Yep.
So
that's understandable.
Nice. I'm glad you've got an emphasis on that. Because like you said, there's so many financial advisors, there's so many people, and everybody's doing what they're doing.
Yeah.
We always need to be finding, you know, finding opportunity in the margins, wherever that may be. So,
right.
So at least you're intentional to find that. So.
Yeah, that's the idea, right? Plus on a self-serving level, I'm like, well, it's interesting to me.
Yeah, right. So. You want to be engaged every day at work. Right?
I do. I've had roles in the past where I'm like, this is great and fun, and then like 4 months later I go, well, there's nothing really left to learn right now.
Yeah,
so I'm kind of done.
But ultimately at the end of the day, as a financial advisor, you're still orchestrating. you're still mm-hmm. conducting a plan yep. For people, and you know, taking all of the information in, and you've got the strings and the woodwind, you know, you've got yeah. all the different things, the percussion, and, yeah. and bringing all those things together for somebody's portfolio.
Yep.
It's just a different title.
Well said. Yeah, there's a bunch of different tools and strategies, not schools. Let's put those words together. Tools and strategies. And our job is to figure out what's going to work best for a client, right? And when I talk to educators in particular, like the phrase in education is backwards design. We're going to start with the ends in mind. We're going to work backwards from there and figure out what is going to be the standard by which we can evaluate. Did we meet those ends? Then we're going to design that evaluation. Then we're going to design experiences that get students there. Well, it's the same thing with financial advice, right? It's choosing what our goal is, or the client choosing what their goal is. We work backwards and evaluate what they have. We work backwards and say, okay, what strategies are getting them to where they are? Are they working or not? And then we implement the things that aren't. Or to use your analogy, we're using the woodwinds at times, we're using percussion at times, and they serve different purposes, mm-hmm. right? But we need to have all of these things at once, granted, weighted differently at different moments, yeah. but we need to have them working in concert, so to speak.
A diversified portfolio.
I've heard that phrase before. someday tell me what that means, please.
yeah. Well, this has been super fun. I won't keep you all day. I finish every podcast with these two questions. So what has been one of your greatest challenges that you've overcome in your life?
That's a tough one. I was thinking of that earlier, and I love the question because it's not easy. My mind goes to a younger version of me being very closed-handed with what I wanted in life.
Okay.
And being kind of bulldoggish about it's this or nothing.
Okay.
Despite pivoting, despite whatever, there's kind of this internal dialogue of, great, I'm doing this now and that's all well and good, but ultimately I want this other thing. Or I don't know, just this general dissatisfaction of things aren't how I had imagined, therefore they're worse. And the challenge then is to be more open-handed, to take life for what it is and what it's given me. Because the reality is it's more heartbreaking, it's more beautiful, it's more satisfying than I ever could have imagined. It just doesn't look like what I thought it would. And that's fine.
That is fine. If one day you're on your deathbed and you look back in everything in totality, the struggle will be beautiful, the challenge will be beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's not always sunshine and rainbows, and that's why I like the question, is because challenge. And I think, you know, we talked about it earlier, modernity and just we kind of control for comfort, and we can mm-hmm. control for pina coladas on the beach, you know. Right. And it's just like that's not always
nothing wrong with that. But
there's going to be times where you got to put your head down and mm-hmm. grind and, mm-hmm. and get through that trouble or whatever trial and tribulations upon you. So
right.
Cool. I like it. I always find it interesting to see how people kind of deal with challenge. And I think it's interesting. So.
There was a moment in my life when I was going to grad school, teaching, and we were in the middle of COVID, and I was going through a divorce all at the same time. And I was kind of like, the only thing that kept me sane was grad school, of all things. Because I would get done teaching from home over a screen and then hole up in my bedroom. And I remember one day in particular, finish my day at 4 or 5 p.m., whatever it was, grab a bite to eat. And then I was studying until like 4:30 a.m. the next day. And I got up at 7, you know, I was like, okay, I would get up at 6, whatever, to start teaching at 7, whatever it was, too short of a night. And I remember going to bed that night at 4:30 and going, well, that was fun. I would do that again. I'm like, thank goodness for studying something interesting, right? Because that keeps me, keeps my feet on the ground a little bit. But yeah, those moments are something else, right?
Well, and I think that's why it makes it so beautiful to get your master's and get through grad school. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's not easy. It wasn't designed to be easy.
Right.
It was designed to take you to your limits.
Right.
So good on you for that. And then finally, who do you want to be? Who does David want to be?
That's a hard question. That's a hard question. Like an easy question in that, like I can answer, what do I want to be?
Yeah. That's the easy thing.
That's the easy thing. So hats off to you for answering a hard one, asking a hard one. I think at the end of the day, I want to be a good man. I want to be somebody who left things better than I found them.
Cool.
I want to be a husband who my wife I day looks back at and goes, oh yeah, he remembered the little things. He remembered why that was important to me. He took care of this thing and didn't forget about it. Or he showed me I matter in XYZ way. I want to be the father who my daughter grows up and goes, yeah, he was there. He was always there. Man, that's a hard question.
I was joking on the boat the other day. We were talking, and I think millennials can take some heat sometimes culturally.
Yeah.
But I argue that we are some of the most involved present fathers we've had. And so I'll die on that hill.
Yeah. Yeah. Was it The Daily a year ago or a handful of months ago had an episode about parenting, like shifts in trends of parenting over the past couple years, and how we're more involved now as parents, regardless of age, than we ever have been.
Oh, cool.
And but like, well, yeah, millennials are parents now, and we're intense, if nothing else.
Yeah. It is. Well, cool. And contemplate that one, because I don't think you'll ever hit the target.
No.
As long as you're striving for it. Oh, excuse me. Well, cool. David, that was a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And that was David Klock. And if you need to, or actually, better question, where can people find you if they need to find David?
Google my name. There's not many David Klocks in the world.
My Klock last with name a K.
Is K-L-O-C-K. Yeah, or david.klock@nm.com.
Cool. Awesome.
November Mary. November, what's the M for military folks?
Mike.
Oh,
NovemberMike.com.
Yep. It's different in Spanish. That's why my military wife has not taught me the English version yet.
Cool. Well, awesome, dude. Have a great rest of your day. You too. Thanks for coming on.
Indeed. Thanks for having me.
All right. We'll see you.